Hey everyone, Becca Reiswig here, and you're listening to So That's What Happened. We're a little late returning this year. Things have been pretty hectic around my house. But we're going to kick off the new year with an old episode. This episode was a patron only over on my Patreon last year. It's a story that I enjoyed learning about, and I'm excited to be moving it over here for everyone to listen to. And it is the story of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. The big ships like the Indianapolis didn't have sonar, and they required some destroyers to be with them. Here we were, going from Guam to the Philippines without a destroyer escort. They assured the captain everything was all right. We left thinking everything was fine. July 30th was a black, dark night, and that submarine skipper, he looked towards the east, and here was a little speck that he recognized as a ship. We were coming right toward him, or fairly close, and he crash-dove, got in position, put his periscope on us, and watched us. Lowell Dean Cox, Seaman Second Class. The first time I heard of the plight of the Indianapolis was from shark hunter Sam Quint in one of my favorite movies, Jaws. I watched Jaws for the first time close to 10 years ago when I was studying film in college. It was required viewing for a class, and I fell in love. It was fun and interesting, incredibly well shot with engaging dialogue and wonderful acting, and just the right amount of cheesy. Much of the story stayed with me, but Quint's tale of survival following the sinking of this battleship made me curious. The first time I looked into the story, it was coming off that first viewing of Jaws, and a time in my life where sharks were one of the most fascinating things in the world to me. They still are, to a degree. So of course, this story of surviving a ridiculous number of sharks in the Pacific stood out. Next came a general interest in World War II. During my spare time in college, not that there was much, I absorbed information about the war at a truly alarming rate. As much of my fascinations go, I was borderline obsessed. And then I learned about the trial that wraps up the story. It added a layer of intrigue to this tale of survival that caught my interest again. So what is it about the sinking of the USS Indianapolis that makes it a standout story in an environment rife with interesting tales? A large part of it is the frankly bizarre series of events that had to occur exactly as they did and when they did to even allow for this event to happen the way it did. We'll take a look at the sinking and the aftermath by first looking at, as usual, the world around the events. In this case, we must start with the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project began in 1942, after several years of build-up. This name is the codename that largely came to be attached with the R&D project into the feasibility of a nuclear bomb by the US with assistance from the UK and Canada. This project came to fruition with the bombings of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and Nagasaki 3 days later on the 9th. While a large chunk of the project has since been released to the public, it was a very closely guarded secret at the time. The secrecy of everything involved with the bombs is something that will come into play later. So in case you didn't guess yet, the Indianapolis sank in 1945, July 30th to be specific. Germany had surrendered to both the Allied forces and the Soviets by May 9, 1945, which means the Allied attention was now focused near solely on Japan. By the end of May, Okinawa had been captured. This was the last step needed to stage a direct assault on Japan itself. Allied leadership was worried, though. The Japanese soldiers did not surrender. They fought till there were none of them left. Something drastic would have to be done to convince them to stop. To keep the number of casualties low, a decisive blow had to be struck. At least, this is the story we often hear. Modern historians have conflicting ideas on whether the atomic bombs actually being used was necessary, rather than using the threat of them. Even contemporaries of the war seem to have been split on whether it was the right choice. Between both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, an estimated 200,000 people were killed. Regardless of whether the loss of these lives saved even more, we can all agree that what happened was horrific. Japan formally surrendered on September 2, 1945. These were the only two uses of atomic bombs on populated areas. Alright, general history out of the way. Next up is the history of the USS Indianapolis before her sinking. She was built by the New York Shipbuilding Corporation in Camden, New Jersey, and first launched on November 7th, 1931. To give you an idea of her size, the Indianapolis was about 600 feet long. She received her commission on November 15th, 1932. This means she essentially entered active duty on that day. Before World War II began, the ship did quite a bit of sailing here and there through the Atlantic, Guantanamo Bay, the Panama Canal, up and down the East Coast, Hawaii, and California, to name a few. She also played host to various political leaders, including President Franklin Roosevelt. During the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the Indianapolis was not in port. Instead, she was running exercises. If she had been there, this may be a very different story. She did partake in the New Guinea and Aleutian Island campaigns in 1942, as well as serving in a variety of positions in 43, 44, and 45, including the landings on Iwo Jima and Okinawa. Suffice to say, she saw combat and was an experienced veteran by the time of her fatal encounter in 45. Finally, let's take a gander at the Indianapolis' role in the bombing of Hiroshima. On July 16th, she departed San Francisco following extensive repairs with a cargo of enriched uranium. This uranium was on its way to Tinian Island, where it would be used to construct the atomic bomb that would be dropped on Hiroshima. This mission was hush-hush, so no one could know where they were going or, after they left, where they were coming from, to prevent the enemy from looking too closely at what was happening on the island. On July 30th, when it was still deep in the night, the USS Indianapolis was struck by two torpedoes from the Japanese sub I-58. Santos Pena, seaman first class, reported, "I heard an explosion, which knocked me off the ready box, knocking me on the deck. I had no time to get off the deck before I heard the second explosion. I got up as soon as the second explosion and looked forward and found the whole bow was gone. I tried to get communication between sky control and the bridge using sound power phones and the ship's service phones, but both were out of operation." Because of the heavy guns she carried, the Indianapolis was top heavy. Within 12 minutes of being struck, she had fully capsized. The crew numbered at 1,195. Of these, it's estimated that around 300 men went down with the ship. The remaining men were left adrift. Many of the men were injured in the initial attack, and there was not enough life rafts or life vests available. The picture I had in my mind of the story at this point after hearing Quint's telling was of a massacre carried out by sharks, most of which would have actually been oceanic white tips with a handful of tigers. More than likely, no great whites would have been there. While it is true that there were a great many sharks that would have picked off men, there is no way to tell how many died of shark attacks as opposed to exposure, exhaustion, dehydration, or wounds received during the submarine attack. Nevertheless, this is still considered the greatest number of lives lost to sharks in modern history. Some of the survivors have stated that they never saw any sharks. Most were not as lucky. The sharks tended to leave the larger groups alone since the men would work together to drive them off. Numbers created safety, warmth, and a way to rest. The chances of rescue were slim, but hope came after 4 days and 5 nights. A Navy pilot caught sight of the survivors and radioed in their location. A nearby destroyer, the USS Cecil Doyle, was dispatched to retrieve them, along with 6 other ships and an amphibious patrol plane. The plane was the first to arrive, though was unable to take many men on board. Instead, it served as a flotation device for 56 of the survivors, since it could not take off weighed down as it was. Once the Cecil Doyle arrived, it took most of the night, but the survivors were brought aboard. Roughly 900 men survived the initial attack and sinking. Only 316 were rescued on August 2nd. They were discovered by chance, not because a distress call was received, or because someone noticed they were missing. How is this possible? How could an entire battleship disappear and no one notice? This is where we get into a series of extraordinary events. When it came to plotting the locations of the Navy's ships, these were not based on reports, but rather projections with ships of the Indianapolis' size. It was assumed that, unless they sent word, the ship would arrive where it was going on time. So, unless they heard differently, command would assume that she had reached her destination. This begs the question, why didn't they hear differently? Well, she was recorded as arriving on time, despite the operations officer for the port being aware that the Indianapolis was not there. For some indecipherable reason, he simply never investigated this or reported it in a timely fashion. Additionally, records have since been declassified that confirmed distress signals were sent. They were ignored because one commander was drunk, another had ordered to not be disturbed, and a third thought it was a Japanese trick. And finally, I know, I put all of this build-up into the tragedy as being directly related to the atomic bomb in some way, and yet, it wasn't. Not really. The fact that the Indianapolis had been transporting uranium before it sank is something that has been used as a reason for the appalling lack of reaction from the Navy sooner. In truth, the secrecy around where she would have been was no longer any greater at this point than the secrecy around the location of any other battleship. Her secret mission merely became a convenient out for several years. Another tragedy to come from the sinking of the Indianapolis was that of her commander, Captain Charles McVeigh. Following the sinking, he was court-martialed. The two charges he was brought up on were failing to order his men to abandon ship and what has been referred to as hazarding the ship. The first charge was quickly dropped. However, the hazarding charge remained. He was accused of placing his ship in danger by not following a zigzag pattern. The sailing pattern would have been used to make it difficult for the enemy to get a clear shot and helped increase the chances of fewer torpedoes making impact. His sentence was remitted when it came to light that he had not been informed of Japanese movement in the area and the testimony of Mochitsura Hashimoto, commander of the I-58, that zigzagging would have made no difference. 23 years following the disaster, Captain McVeigh committed suicide at the age of 70. While the survivors of the Indianapolis did not blame him for what had happened, the families of some of the lost did. It wasn't until 1996 that the case was reevaluated. On September 14, 1999, several of the survivors testified on Captain McVeigh's behalf. In October of 2000, Congress decided that his record should show that Captain McVeigh was exonerated of all charges, and President Bill Clinton signed the resolution. July 24, 2020, shortly before the 75th anniversary of the sinking, the survivors of the USS Indianapolis were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. So that's what happened. A ship and the majority of her crew were lost. The sinking of the USS Indianapolis is one of the greatest naval tragedies in US history. What makes it worse is that it was a tragedy that could have ended with many more men still living. An estimated 600 lives were lost between the sinking and the rescue of the survivors. If you're interested in learning more, I would highly recommend the book Indianapolis, The True Story of the Worst Sea Disaster in U.S. Naval History and the 50-Year Fight to Exonerate an Innocent Man by Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek, especially if you're interested in the story of Captain McVeigh. I also found Seth Peridon's article for the National World War II Museum's website, Surviving the Sinking of the USS Indianapolis, where he told Harlan Twibble's story, particularly helpful. Thank you all so much for subscribing to my stories and supporting me here on Patreon. It really means a lot to me that you believe in the content that I'm putting out enough to support me financially. On that fourth day, I said, "I hear a plane," and we began to splash water, we began to yell, we began to pray, everything. And seemingly, when he got to a point that he had gone any further, he would have gone over us. You know what he did? He made a dive. Edgar Harrell, Marine Corporal.